The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine, the February 23, 2026 edition. This is Time in large block capital lettering in white with gradations into blue. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. It says Leading Minneapolis because there's a photograph on the cover of ICE agents in a pool or a cloud of tear gas with white cloudiness in the foreground and in the background, defoliated trees, and beyond that even, a blue sky. The first article in the View section is entitled Our Age of Distrust, Society is the heading, by Richard Edelman. Let's see what Edelman's credentials are. He's the CEO of Edelman, E-D-E-L-M-A-N, a global communications firm. In 1624, the English poet John Donne wrote, No man is an island entire of itself. And yet in 2026, the Edelman Trust Barometer finds 7 out of 10 people across 28 nations are hesitant or unwilling to trust people who have different values, approaches to societal problems, or backgrounds than they do. For most people, distrust is now the default instinct. Only one-third tell us most people can be trusted. Our survey of 33,938 respondents suggests we are choosing a closed ecosystem of trust that mandates a limited worldview, a narrowing of opinion, intellectual stasis, and cultural rigidity. Respondents with insular mindsets say they would have profoundly lower trust in an institution if it were led by anyone different from them. Too often we withdraw from dialogue and compromise. We opt for the safety of the familiar over the perceived risk of innovation. We prefer nationalism to global connection. We choose individual benefit over common advancement. How did we get here? In its quarter century, the Trust Barometer has captured an inexorable erosion of belief in institutions and their leaders. Trust is increasingly local to one's employer, CEO, and social circle. Worldwide, we find trust among high earners 15 points higher than among low earners. That gap is 29 points in the U.S. concerns about downward economic mobility and job losses due to globalization have increased political polarization. COVID bred doubt about government edicts and skepticism about science, provoking an existential battle for truth. Tensions have led to nationalism, hostility to global agreements, a reorientation of trade flows. Last year, the barometer documented a descent into grievance, with 6 in 10 telling us they feel business and government actions harmed them and served the interests of only some, and that the system unfairly favors the rich. Today, our collective mindset has pulled back from alarm and anger into the hard shell of insularity. The consequences of insularity include, first, resistance to change. Our November flash poll, Trust and Artificial Intelligence at a Crossroads, found that by over a 2-to-1 ratio, the U.S., U.K., and Germany reject the growing use of AI. In the U.S., 70% believe CEOs are not telling the truth about job losses due to AI. Second, we see pervasive nationalism with deep preference for domestic over foreign brands, 31 points in Canada. Third, societies are losing the capacity to act, with climate action stalled in favor of short-term economic interest and urgent local projects like affordable housing blocked. Most troubling is the global loss of optimism. On average, only 15% of people in developed markets believe the next generation will be better off. The Asian powerhouses of Singapore, Thailand, India, and China all show double-digit declines in this optimism since last year. Fortunately, there is a way to counter insularity, brokering trust. A trust broker helps to create a path for progress and cooperation despite insularity by surfacing common interests and translating realities. There's a tremendous opportunity for employers to be brokers of trust because they are both proximate and reliable. They are the only group who a majority reports are doing well. The office is now considered the safest space for discussion of difficult topics because there are rules for behavior. It is at work we address challenges such as AI, globalization, and affordability head on. Crucially, you can see tangible change in day-to-day life when leaders commit to new decisions. Why should employers embrace this role as brokers of trust? Insularity is a bottom line issue, undermining productivity, causing churn, threatening the basic ability to lead. There must be frank discussions in the workplace led by the CEO or other leaders. But business leaders should not be alone in the fight against insularity. Visible members of the community, such as doctors or pastors, should be trusted partners in furthering dialogue. Countering insularity will require all community stakeholders step up to the challenge. John Donne was right to conclude his poem with an admonition, "Therefore send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." We are becoming inflexible, intolerant, incoherent in our cocoons. The risks to society from manic swings in popular sentiment to rejection of innovation are real. We must ensure self-righteous perspectives give way to belief in the future. We all have a role to play in establishing trust and defeating insularity in our communities, but employers especially have an opportunity to lead the way. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. There's a photograph here. It's not very large, but it's in color. It shows a large white airplane. Written on the airplane side is Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in English and something in Arabic, perhaps the same statement. Two individuals dressed as Middle Eastern sheikhs are walking toward the camera along a blue runway area, and flanking them on either side are military members. Some are dressed in khaki green, some are dressed in white, all are carrying long rifles. The caption reads, MBZ welcomes MBS to Abu Dhabi in 2024. The Middle East has lately been a surge, or it's seen a surge of violence and instability. Israel's war with Hamas expanded to include Iranian proxies like Hezbollah and Yemen's Houthi rebels. An insurrection ousted Syria's strongman and replaced him with a shaky Islamist coalition. Israel and the U.S. directly struck Iran, which in recent weeks has faced an intense wave of protests within its borders. The regime has responded with a ferocity remarkable, even by Iran's standards. But there is another emerging rivalry with important implications, both inside and beyond the greater Middle East. The partnership between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, once grounded in a common mission to transform the Gulf Cooperation Council countries into a global center for innovation and an engine for growth in finance, tourism, and transport, has passed from intensifying competition for foreign investment to indirect conflict over the region's security order. This increasingly public feud is in part a result of personal rivalry between the Saudi kingdom's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, and the UAE's Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, MBZ. It's also a product of past friction within OPEC Plus, the oil cartel in which the Saudis dominate, and the UAE is the bloc's third largest exporter. Saudi spending on extraordinary new real estate projects leaves its government in need of continuous waves of new revenue. But Emirati officials have come to resent Saudi insistence on export limits meant to prop up prices. The UAE's willingness to bust its quota by producing more has often set Saudi teeth on edge, though this issue has cooled since the Saudis decided to export more themselves to regain market share. The bigger issue now is Saudi frustration with what they see as an increasingly assertive Emirati foreign policy, one that often runs counter to Saudi interests. In particular, the two Gulf states back opposing sides in armed conflicts in Sudan, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia. Add Israel to the mix. With the war in Gaza and Israel's militarily aggressive approach to Iran and its various regional proxies, the Saudis have come to see Benjamin Netanyahu's government as a source of deepening instability. The UAE's willingness to partner with Israel in various security and commercial projects leads the Saudi leadership to fear a form of encirclement that might stunt the growth of Saudi influence. Then in December, tensions briefly erupted into the open when an Emirati-backed force inside Yemen seized control of two large provinces there, one of them sharing a border with the Saudi kingdom. A furious bin Salman ordered airstrikes that sent that force scrambling into retreat. The Emiratis appear to have backed down, but tensions remain high. For now, most outside attention on the Middle East will remain focused on risks of upheaval in Iran and on the threat of another round of direct American strikes in that country. Which some in the Trump administration hope can create enough chaos to inspire more insurrection. The Israelis, too, are a wild card. But the Saudi-UAE rivalry introduces real risk at the heart of the Arab world's most dynamic region. Other important players can help keep the peace between them. For example, Pakistan has signed a landmark defense pact with the Saudis, but it wants closer commercial relations with the Emiratis. Egypt relies heavily on investment from the UAE. But it remains aligned with Saudi-backed groups in neighboring Sudan. More importantly, for now, the two governments appear to recognize the need for guardrails imposed by financial realities as each state continues its economic diversification and reform agendas. But if competition within conflict zones in highly unstable neighboring countries continues to pull Saudi Arabia and the UAE into costly proxy competitions, the rivalry could burn up resources better spent on each state's further development. And in the Middle East, where alignments and alliances are shifting quickly, particularly as Iran's regional clout collapses, the risk remains that Saudi-Emirati frictions will create more areas for open conflict, and an already unstable region could become a lot more complicated. Here is the DC brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. President Donald Trump last year successfully wrestled control of one of the nation's dominant performing arts stages with unheard-of efficiency. He ousted its leader, installed a loyalist at the helm, made himself chairman of its reconstituted board, scrambled its programming calendar, alienated cultural leaders, exiled its resident opera company, declared himself the MC of its biggest fundraising gala, and treated it like an annex of the White House for events that cast him as the headliner. Just so no one doubted his total ownership, in December he put his name on the building, formerly known as the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts. Naturally, Trump took top billing. Now, barely a year back in Washington, Trump abruptly announced on social media, February 1, that he is shutting the Kennedy Center entirely for 2 years, basically the rest of his term, so he can reopen it in the waning days of his last year in power with a ballyhooed blitz. In a city largely numb to Trump's capricious moves, this one had everyone doing a double take. As one former Kennedy Center staffer messaged, he really does think this whole place is the boardroom of The Apprentice, doesn't he? Trump's latest move came with no warning to the Kennedy Center staff or performers, let alone those who had been hoping to make an appearance there in the coming years. It is a loss that cuts at a pillar of Washington's performing arts community, or would if the Kennedy Center's place in local and national culture had not taken such a dramatic nosedive over the past year, as audiences stayed away from a complex consumed by partisanship. Trump claims the building's in disrepair and in need of years of improvements. Speaking with reporters February 2, the president hinted he intended to take the building down to its shell. I'm not ripping it down. I'll be using the steel. So we're using the structure. We're using some of the marble, and some of the marble comes down, Trump said. It is not clear if this means he takes a dim view of the $250 million expansion the Kennedy Center unveiled in 2019. Yes, that was during Trump's first term. That would indicate the closure is not actually about building repairs, but rather an attempt to save face over an empty dance card, as some in Washington privately suspect. It is a dizzying turn for a hallowed artistic institution that spent half a century as a steady presence dedicated to finding ways to promote American identity, whether with Condoleezza Rice joining Yo-Yo Ma for a surprise classical duet, or Diana Ross teaming up with the National Symphony Orchestra for a night of disco. It was, in the simplest of terms, a roulette wheel of high and low, formal and feisty. It was where world-class soprano Renee Fleming could record a podcast on neuroscience, The Roots could serve a hip-hop residency, Turandot could find a new ending, and Holland Taylor could take on the role of Texas Governor Ann Richards in a one-woman play. All the while, more than a million students rotated through for educational visits each year. Then came Trump, a developer and branding master before jumping into politics, Trump has long confused disruption with distinction. He was so divisive in his first term that artists refused to set foot in the Kennedy Center if he were there. The Kennedy Center Honors, the campus's biggest gala, went on during his first term, only after Trump promised to stay away. It was a slight that the president would not forget. Within weeks of coming back, Trump dismissed the center's widely respected president and put in her place his former spy chief, Rick Grenell. Artists canceled quicker than the list could be updated, from a production of Hamilton to a sold-out Issa Rae show. "There's no way I would set foot in it now," Wicked composer Stephen Schwartz said when he bailed on his role in an upcoming National Opera fundraiser. While the administration's policies were a major deterrent, the changes in how the Kennedy Center was being run certainly played a role. As another Kennedy staffer noted, Trump broke decades of tradition in booking shows that featured performers who were not part of the stage union. There was also plenty of evidence rival venues were booking shows that would have normally taken their turn at the Kennedy Center. The cancellations escalated when Trump had his name installed on the building in December. In January, Philip Glass pulled a work commissioned by the National Symphony, saying Trump's posture toward the arts was in conflict with his intentions behind a symphony paying tribute to Abraham Lincoln. That led the National Symphony's chief conductor to lament to the New York Times, "I cannot make everybody happy." The public has noticed the tumult. Ticket sales have dropped off dramatically. And it is not uncommon to have plenty of empty seats greeting performers who've been vocal about wanting politics out of their auditoriums. Instead, at most programs, the national anthem serves as an overture. The dissonance around Washington has not bent Trump. When it came time for last year's Kennedy Center Honors, he dictated the list himself and hinted the next season's schedule would be of his making, befitting the nation's 250th anniversary. Instead, it's going to a season of silence starting July 4. The future of the Kennedy Center Honors and another high-profile event, the Mark Twain Prize, remains an open question, as does a home for existing residents like the National Symphony. Maybe that is the lowest level of drama available. Things had become increasingly problematic for the center as marquee acts declined to book their Washington tours at the Kennedy Center, opting instead for venues around town. Even the Washington National Opera, which had increased its endowment from $8 million to $30 million since 2018, left the center to find a home elsewhere, rather than continue under the baton of Maestro Trump and his terms. It fits with the broader pattern of Trump demolishing, in some cases literally, traditionally staid institutions in Washington. He's already leveled the east wing of the White House, paved over the Jacqueline Kennedy Rose Garden, slapped his name on a State Department building, annexed D.C.'s golf courses, mauled a new terminal for the region's main international airport, even edited text about him in Smithsonian exhibitions to erase his past impeachments. There's talk of a Paris-style arch named after him, too, that would dwarf the nearby Lincoln Memorial. But the unilateral decision to upgrade or tear down the Kennedy Center is a step beyond. The Kennedy Center is a quasi-governmental arts organization chartered by Congress, but funded mostly with private dollars and ticket sales, meaning it is not exactly clear how Trump's getting away with his summary closure. Grenell, the Kennedy Center's Trump-picked chief, acknowledged in a note to staff that the shuttering was an on-the-fly operation. We recognize this creates many questions as we plan to temporarily close most of our operations. We will have more information about staffing and operational changes in the coming days, he said in a memo. In a public statement, Grinnell followed up with Trumpist bravado. I am confident this sets the stage for a stronger, revitalized national cultural and entertainment complex. A stage, of course, dictated by Trump's aesthetics, and that will put him in the spotlight. After all, in his mind, America is but a one-man show. The next column is In the Loop by Andrew R. Chow, tech correspondent. For some parents, the idea of AI toys sounds like an appealing alternative to plopping kids in front of the TV. Multiple studies point to the idea of screens damaging brain development. Maybe toys that learn about kids' personalities and converse with them could stimulate playtime in a more interactive, hands-on way. But a slew of other studies have emerged, revealing the many downsides of this first generation of AI toys. The latest one, from Common Sense Media, released January 22, warns that AI toys introduce serious risks to children's development, privacy, and safety. Researchers found the toys create emotional attachment by design and collect extensive voice recordings. They also found that 27% of AI toy outputs included inappropriate content about mature topics. Last fall, researchers found an AI teddy bear on the market, gave instructions on lighting a match, and responded to questions about sex and drugs. OpenAI pulled the company's access to its AI models, and sales were suspended, yet many other AI toys are already on shelves and in homes. Nearly half of parents surveyed by Common Sense have either purchased or are considering purchasing AI-enabled toys. And in China, the AI toy industry is worth $4 billion. There may come a day when AI toys are a worthy upgrade to the classic teddy bear, but that day is not today. Most toys are required to undergo rigorous safety testing, but we still lack meaningful child safeguards for AI, Common Sense Media's CEO James P. Steyer said in a statement. Parents should proceed with caution. The View essay under the topic Health. What Winter Gives Back by Elizabeth Kelsey, who is a writer and clinical mental health counselor. In my early 30s, I relocated to rural New Hampshire from Florida. It was supposed to be a joyful and exciting time. I was in love and had moved north with the intention of building a life with my husband. It was also stressful. The losses of friends and community hit me harder than I realized. Compounding these changes was the loss of warmth and light. I was unprepared for a New Hampshire winter. Late that first autumn, after picking apples and watching the leaves turn maroon, I found myself overwhelmed by winter realities I had not considered. I was not prepared for the ice. Before work, my Volvo was fully encrusted, the door frozen shut. Items left in the car for a few hours transformed, like the shampoo in my gym bag that became a solid block. On other days, snow barricaded the front door. I did not consider how roads could become unnavigable because of layers of white. I had never heard the ominous term black ice until I described to coworkers the way my fiancé and I spun like a dreidel on Route 120 on our commute home. I was unaware of the minutes added to seemingly every task, from defrosting and scraping the car to dressing myself before I left home, I learned that my wardrobe was inadequate too. The cold made my fingers and toes ache and my lungs burn. Approaching the winter solstice, the light departed long before 5 p.m. Days were short, and the darkness and my dark moods were perhaps the hardest thing of all. I became tearful at inconveniences, like when the salad I packed for lunch froze to a crisp. I also felt a deeper sense of despair. Although I was happy in my relationship, at times I profoundly regretted my move from Florida. Problems that could be addressed, like my dissatisfaction with my office job, seemed insurmountable. Past traumas in my life, bullying from my childhood, family alcoholism, resurfaced, lurking in my mind like unwelcome guests from October to April. This cycle of emotional darkness let up by spring as the days lengthened. I recognized the pattern. I sought treatment for seasonal affective disorder. I used light boxes and received cognitive behavioral therapy, but every year for several years, my mood changed with the time change. 17 years later, as snow spirals outside my window and gathers on the pines, I reflect on why winter is no longer such a struggle. The shift was so gradual, I did not perceive it. My life circumstances altered in the intervening years, certainly. In the course of that time, I got divorced from the person I had moved north to be with. I made more fulfilling friendships and connections than that relationship provided, and I found a vocation instead of a job. My soul grew warmer. I developed winter hacks. I wrapped string lights around my curtain rods well before the holiday season and kept them up until St. Patrick's Day. I took noon walks to make the most of the sunshine and to feel my feet on the frozen earth. I reframed snow shoveling as a cardio strength workout. I mastered the art of layering and discovered micro spikes. Most of all, though, I learned to accept winter instead of resisting it. It was this acceptance that allowed me to change. Now I welcome the limitations that let me slow down from the frenetic activity of warmer months. I appreciate the opportunity to rest. I take in what light I can, and I luxuriate in the warmth and even beauty that I find. A snowstorm can be peaceful. It covers the earth in a fresh start. A blue and pale pink Vermont dawn I've seen can rival a Florida sunset. After my divorce, I could have returned to Florida, but I've become accustomed to an all-season life. Winter reminds me that when something is taken away, we cherish it all the more. And winter gives something back. It teaches resilience. Now I know I can manage discomfort and cope through this harsh season. I can trust that longer, lighter days will inevitably return. I can navigate change. I can even change myself. The next article is lengthy, and I will abbreviate it. The first part is one column, and then it moves into a longer format. Iran on the Edge, and this is written by Carl Vick. This is one column. The men who ruled the Islamic Republic of Iran came to power in 1979 after millions of ordinary people filled the streets to demand the end of a despotic regime. Looking out their windows in the first days of 2026, they knew exactly what they were seeing on thoroughfares and boulevards. They also knew how to clear them. January 8, Iranian authorities shut down the internet and gave security forces their orders. What followed was one of the most intensive massacres by gunfire since World War II. In Tehran alone, thousands were killed. Although the precise toll is difficult to verify, Iranian health officials tell Time that the numbers could far exceed most estimates, with 30,000 people killed nationwide in 48 hours. President Donald Trump had promised the U.S. would come to the rescue. It did not. The regime claimed victory. As January wound down, the president pointed toward the USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier group and pressed the Ayatollahs for a deal. Iranians counted the dead. In the pages that follow, five Iranian writers essay the state of the country they long to return to. Known for most of its 2,600 years as Persia, it's been the Islamic Republic of Iran for less than half a century, a radical, catastrophic experiment in governance whose final hours will be determined by ordinary people now driven indoors by truck-mounted machine guns. Meanwhile, Iran's economy is in freefall, and the despots quail. As one exiled journalist put it in 2022, the last time Iranians reclaimed public spaces, I don't know if this is the final episode of the Islamic Republic, but it is the final season. Turning the page to the next article. This is longer, and I will abbreviate it. When I think of Iran, I think of light, by Asfar Nafisi. Nafisi's author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. When a friend asked Henry James how he endured the devastation of World War I, the writer replied, "Feel, feel, feel all you can." His exhortation contains the essence of what it means to remain human. Totalitarian regimes try to dismantle our capacity to feel, render us numb, confiscate our humanity, the way censors black out passages in books. When I think of Iran, I think of light. I think of the play of light on leaves, on water, on mountains. I was born in Tehran, and when I looked out of the window of my living room, I would look at Mount Damavand, our tallest mountain peak, covered with a halo of snow. I think of that. And I think of our poetry nights in Tehran. I think of the writer and editor Hushang Golshiri teaching us classical Iranian poets during our poetry nights. I think of reading Ferdowsi and Nizami in our living room and the living rooms of my friends. In December, the Iranians rose up in protest. The Islamic Republic spoke its only language, violence, and again the morgues and graveyards of Iran received fathers and sons, mothers and daughters. For me, as for millions of Iranians, this struggle is not political, it is existential. The first thing the Islamic Republic did, like any totalitarian system, was take away our right to live. They did it by literally killing people. They did it by trying to reshape the citizens, turn us into figments of their imagination, to create a new Iranian. I was teaching in Tehran during the revolution in 1979. I did not know myself at the time. The Islamic Republic made me understand a lot of things by taking them away. They were confiscating my history and my identity as a human being. They were depriving us of contact with the world, making us believe nobody cared about us. I felt the isolation they imposed upon us was a trap. We could escape only by feeling, living, and resisting. When I was leaving Tehran, my mother followed me around the apartment. "Tell them," she kept saying. "Tell them. Tell the world what's happening to us." I had to write, as Primo Levi put it, in order to rejoin the community of mankind. Last night, I could not sleep. I kept thinking of three people. The only way I can repay my debt to them is to keep them alive through their stories. So I will tell you of Dr. Farokru Parsa, P-A-R-S-A. She was principal of my high school in Tehran. She was very strict. She would stand at our high school door, checking the length of our uniforms. We would make poems and stories about her. She became, along with my mother, one of the first six women to be elected to the Iranian parliament in 1964. She became Minister of Education, changed the representation of women in school textbooks, and significantly advanced the education of girls and women in Iran. The Islamic Republic came for her. They charged her with crimes from propagating corruption and prostitution to violating Islamic morality. A revolutionary tribunal in Tehran declared her a corrupter on earth and sentenced her to death in May 1980. The legend is they put her in a sack because you're not supposed to touch a woman and killed her by shooting at the sack. Some say they just hanged her or stoned her. It was a time when I felt immense despair. Many Iranians wrote what is believed to be Dr. Parsa's last message from her prison cell to her children. I am not going to bow to those who expect me to express regret for 50 years of my efforts for equality between men and women. I am not prepared to wear the chador and step back in history. I stayed in Iran, and that brings me to my second story, my second person. He was my student at Allama Tabatabai University in Tehran, where I was teaching English literature during the war with Iraq. He had fought in the war and was very active in the Muslim Students Association, which worked as an instrument of ideological conformity and state control on campuses. He had the power to throw me out of the university or worse. One day, as I was teaching Henry James, we heard this noise in the hall outside. Two students rushed in with the news. This young man has brought two cans of petrol with him, doused himself, and set himself on fire. They have betrayed us, he shouted. They have betrayed us. Some of my students made jokes when his body was being carried out. It made me very unhappy. I scolded them. You do not know what he has done, a student retorted. I realize there's another kind of death. The regime shapes us into likeness. Its likeness hardens the heart. I tried to convey that to my students through the teaching of the novel. A great novel is multivocal and speaks on behalf of many. The novel threatens the lies of a totalitarian regime like the Islamic Republic. The novel nurtures curiosity and empathy. My third story is about Razia. I remember only her first name. In 1979, I was teaching contemporary American fiction at a small girls' college in Tehran. Razia was my student. She was a practicing Muslim. Her mother was a cleaning lady. Her father was dead. She was a thin, small girl with her veil framing her face. She was serious. I can still see her face when I close my eyes. Razia would walk with me to the university gates, and we would talk about Henry James and Jane Austen. She fell in love with Henry James. She loved the independent women in his stories. These women sacrificed their happiness, but they did the right thing, she would say. Razia was curious. Curiosity, the desire to know another, is insubordination in its purest form, as Vladimir Nabokov said. You do not accept just what is, but seek what could be or should be. After that term, I moved to Tehran University. I saw Razia once on the street. She gave me a sign not to talk to her. It was the year after the revolution, and the repression had started. Some years later, Matab, another former student of mine, came to see me at Allama Tabatabai University, where I was teaching at the time. She'd been in jail, but had been released for good behavior. She had met Razia in jail. Razia and Mahtab had forged a bond in prison over their love of literature. Razia would talk about Henry James. Mahtab would talk about F. Scott Fitzgerald. At a certain point in her telling, Mahtab paused. You know, Razia was executed. I can still see her, even in prison. Even while waiting for her execution, Razia chose life. She reached far beyond her prison cell through literature. Her bond with the novels and stories of Henry James transcended death and reaffirmed life. When I lived in Iran, my father would tell me this country is very ancient and was invaded many times. What gives us identity and continuity, he would say, is our poetry stretching back hundreds of years to Ferdowsi, Hafiz, Jami, and Saadi. When this regime came to power, they did more than arrest and kill poets and writers. They tried to erase our cultural memory. They tried to destroy the statue of Ferdowsi, our epic poet, and rename the street honoring Omar Khayyam, our poet, astronomer, and philosopher. But Iranian women stood in front of that street sign and would not let them change it. It was one small victory among countless defeats. The regime would call our cultural traditions pagan, but Iranians still make pilgrimages to the shrines of our poets. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the Soviet Union of the Muslim world, a modern theocracy with imperialist ambition, and it is an ideology, a system that has failed. When I look at the younger generation in Iran, I see hope. The protests are both new and rooted in our history. Women have been fighting for freedoms, gaining ground despite oppression. What gives me hope is seeing women and men, the merchants and the retirees, all sections of Iranian society come together in the recent protests. I've been thinking of Vaclav Havel, who wrote, "Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out." The protesters in Iran show us freedom is an ordeal, and you can pay for it with your life. That was not abridged. My dream for Iran, this is by Arash Azizi, who is author of What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. For years now, I've held on to a very specific dream. I'm somewhere in Tehran, my hometown, canvassing for an election. I knock on an apartment door, and an elderly woman answers, Madar Jan. I address her using the Persian term of endearment and respect. Will you consider voting for the left party of Iran? Sometimes in the dream, she tells me to get lost. Other times, she shows interest, and I explain that our party is socialist, that we want to build more metro stops and open a new factory in the neighborhood. She says she'll think about it. The biggest dream sounds so ordinary. The scene from my dream is commonplace, not only in my adopted home, the U.S., and other liberal democracies, but even in a constrained fashion in neighboring Turkey and Pakistan. For it to come true in Iran, much would have to change. I was born in Iran in 1988. For all but the first year of my life, my homeland has been ruled by the same man, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, supreme leader who has final authority over every major decision but is accountable to no one. I have voted in the elections of the Islamic Republic, but every candidate on every ballot was vetted for total fealty to Khamenei. A political party sharing my own convictions of democratic socialism could not dream of legally existing in Iran. Neither could any political party outside the Islamist framework. This prohibition has kept me away from Iran for years now. My politics renders me persona non grata. Every protest in Iran is a reminder of the Islamic Republic's cruelty and a renewed call for its demise. Even the slightest improvement seems unimaginable without an end to the regime. But I've never believed it enough to simply declare what we oppose, what we do not want. We must also dream of what could be. My very specific fantasies about the Iran of the future are my way of keeping the political imagination alive and open. One day, at the height of the anti-regime mass protests in Iran in 2022, I had a long, tearful conversation with a dear friend. We allowed ourselves to alternate our mourning with dreams about the future. My friend and I, like most Iranians, are embarrassingly exceptionalist about our homeland, convinced that Iran can rival any country in its offerings. We dreamed of working for the Iranian Tourism Board, designing ad campaigns to lure travelers from every corner of the world. Iran's Shiite shrines already draw millions of pilgrims from Muslim countries. We dreamed of a day when millions of Jews might also visit the tomb of Esther and Mordecai and Hamadan, and millions of Baha'is could visit the holiest land of their faith. We dreamed that the Saadi Foundation, a government-run institution dedicated to promoting Persian language, might host well-attended classes in Lisbon, Montreal, and Johannesburg. Instead of its current fare of dour Islamist pretension, it would offer the best of Iranian arts and culture, our cinema, our poetry, perhaps even our wine. I am sure my more artful compatriots would come up with something less tacky, but we did come up with a tagline, "Taste the Shiraz wine that's actually from Shiraz." Of Iran's many squandered possibilities, the waste of our soft power stings the most. Even if Iran never became a robust democracy, couldn't its institutions at least align more closely with our national interests and our cultural heritage? Couldn't we use them not to further some regressive ideology, but to disseminate our culture and leverage it for economic growth? Some might argue that fantasies, by definition, know no bounds. I do not dream of democracy as some promised land of milk and honey, but as what it actually is, a parliament composed of representatives freely chosen by the populace, a chance I would have to persuade a fellow Iranian to vote for my politics. I know that no matter what follows the regime, we are not about to be Denmark. All I want is for us to have a chance to serve our country. The Iranian state was a founding member of both the League of Nations. And the United Nations. Ours is one of a handful of countries never colonized by Europeans. Freed from the ideologues who have held them hostage, even most bureaucrats serving in the Islamic Republic today could rediscover the best of our history and reorient their efforts toward our nation's improvement. In my dreams, I always remember Iran is not mine alone. Like any other country, we have our social progressives and our conservatives, our devout and our atheists, our saints and our crooks. And with so much murder and mayhem in our contemporary history, many Iranians treat one another with suspicion and rancor. But I continue to set my North Star with a slogan once used by Iranian reformists, "Iran for all Iranians." I dream then of lazing on the beautiful beaches of the Caspian Sea or the Persian Gulf, where some Iranians would don a bikini and others a burkini. I dream of frequenting a leftist bookstore on Tehran's fabled Ekalab Street, while others browse its Islamist or libertarian counterparts. In my fantasies, we all share the country together, without tearing it apart for the sake of our vision. As Iranians mourn and bury their loved ones, killed in their thousands by the regime during the current protests, it is hard to speak of fantasies, though I see writing on the wall for the Islamic Republic. I know we have no easy path to democratization, but I will never stop dreaming of the Iran that could be. I will read the first paragraph of the next article, This Isn't Over, by Sharnoush Parsipur. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran resembles a half-lifeless body collapsed on the ground but holding a gun. With the support of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and other military forces, it has attacked the people of Iran and through widespread killings has delivered a brutal blow to the popular uprising. Yet this is only a temporary success. The Republic is already dead, morally, economically, and socially. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again for our office and studios is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.